I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So tonight, as promised, I'm going to be offering the first in the series of talks on the Noble Eightfold Path, which will probably go through October. And as a review, these eight include right understanding or view, which is tonight's talk, right intention, right speech, action, and livelihood, and right effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And before I go on, I want to make sure to just briefly review the word right, because that has a lot of different connotations in the English language, even though it's the traditional way to talk about the Noble Eightfold Path. Sometimes it's called wise or skillful, which I kind of like better, skillful view rather than right. It's not translated well in English. This is because in the West, when we hear the word right, it's like hearing that it's the only way or it's the right way and it has to be done this way and it's kind of dictatorial in some way, or it's, you know, any other way is wrong. That's not at all. It's not at all the definition of right understanding. So in modern day English translation, the word right actually means something more like wholesome, or again, skillful, most beneficial. You can think of it as that, most beneficial. And the idea is its focus is no harm or compassion, which is the key to all of it. It's the whole path is no harm and compassion. How can we be a benefit to ourselves and others and not cause harm? You know? So with each, the goal is essentially to lessen our own suffering as well as the suffering of others. That's the key. And this is really important to remember, actually, especially as we consider the very beginning of the path, which is right view or understanding, samadhita in Pali. And that's what I'll be talking a little bit about tonight very briefly. Right view is also, interestingly, also considered the end of the path and then the beginning again, which I kind of like. So it's really a circling. It's a continual turning. And as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago in the first talk, the Noble Eightfold Path is traditionally illustrated as a wheel, the Dhamma Chakra. Chakra means wheel. And each of these eight parts of the path is a spoke. Okay? So the Buddha's first teaching on the Noble Eightfold Path 2,600 years ago at Deer Park in Sarnath in northern India was considered the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. So it's said to start the wheel of the Dharma, the wheel of the teachings in motion. And I'm committed as a Buddhist teacher to keep that wheel turning. And I have it tattooed on my arm, actually, you know, to remind me of my commitment to keep that wheel turning. And yet, I still find it interesting to note that the Noble Eightfold Path is a path, right? So it's, and whenever a lot of us hear the word path, we usually think of something very linear, don't we? Like, you know, something with a starting point, bless you, and an ending point. Something you walk to get to a destination. It's like, you know, here's a yellow brick road to Oz, and, you know, you follow this to meet the wizard, and there's a linear kind of path. In Buddhist practice, we're not so much trying to get somewhere or to achieve some higher or lofty goal or reward at the end of the rainbow. We're actually walking ourselves home to the place where we started, but with much less baggage. And, you know, we tend to drop things off along the way. So instead of a traditional way of, what am I going to gain? What am I going to get? What am I going to collect? And you have all this baggage. The Buddhist practice, you let go of everything along the way. You drop all your suitcases, if you will, know. In fact, when the Buddha was asked, what have you gained from meditation? He replied, nothing. He said, however, let me tell you what I've lost. He said, what I've lost is anger, anxiety, depression, insecurity, and fear of old age and death. You know? So I looked up the word path in the dictionary, and the very first definition I found was a way or a track laid down for walking or made by continual treading. Made by continual treading. And as far as the Dharma is concerned, this definition makes so much more sense to me. You know, since after almost 3 decades of practice now, I know through my own experience that none of us walk this path once. It's not a path you walk once and then you get somewhere. That's not what, that's why it's a circle. Okay? That's why it's a circle. We walk it over and over, almost like a labyrinth, right? Go back, go back. And along the way, we discover new things. And we may, things we may have passed, for instance, hundreds of times before, never really noticed. If you think about walking down the path, I never noticed that thing. And then suddenly we see them, the teachings. They're visible. It's fascinating. It's like, wow, I've walked this before. Why didn't I see that? You know? It's like these wild animals that have been hiding start to show themselves. We start seeing each individual tree. You know, ash, oak, locust, all pine, all these different trees, rather than just a group of trees that are forest. All of a sudden, in practice, we start seeing, things start to become clear. Oh, there's that. It's really fascinating. And like the paths the cows have made in the fields where I live in a, literally in the middle of a cow pasture. Sometimes I could reach out almost in my window and touch the cows. Each time you walk the path, you know, that the cows have made, that we've made with the Dharma, the path becomes more and more visible and wider and deeper. And the interesting part is that that's what we just start automatically walking because it's so deep and we can see it so clearly. After a while, in fact, you're no longer getting lost as much trying to see where the path is. Even when the fields of life, if you will, get very thick, you know that you know it's there. You can see it clearly. You've walked it enough times that you know exactly where it is. Even if during certain times of the year, certain periods of your life, it's a little shady. Can't quite see it. But it's there. In these modern times, I like to think of the Noble Eightfold Path as like a kind of Buddhist GPS for us. And when I was doing my MBSR training with Dr. John Kabat-Zinn, who as many of you know is the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workshop, I was driving to one of our sessions, we had to drive to one of the sessions, with this man who used to write comedy for Comedy Central and for national radio hosts. And I just, that year, finally bought a GPS, which I love now. I don't know what I did without it. But, you know, I was using it for the very first time, and I wasn't really sure how it worked. I bought it for the trip. So I was like, well, you know, what is this thing? How does it work? And, you know, I hadn't chose, you know, I hadn't even, like, do I want the woman with the English accent or do I want, you know, the more robotic American voice? So this guy was like, hey, you know what? What would the GPS sound like if it was narrated by Jon Kabat-Zinn? Maybe it would say things like, you might start to become more aware of and sense into an upcoming turn on your right. Or like, as you're ready, and if it feels okay to you, you might begin to consider taking a sharp left. I really want them to develop that so much. It would be so good. And some of you might have seen this Zen cartoon that has a monk driving along and his GPS is seeing like things like follow your bliss. The obstacle is the path. If you aim for it, you're turning away from it. No. So if you'll stay with me as I continue with this GPS metaphor. If the Noble Eightfold Path is kind of like our Buddhist GPS, right? Then the first spoke in the wheel, right view, Samadhita, is kind of like being able to zoom that screen all the way out to its fullest so that we can see the full map. We can see the entire landscape, if you will. We make it really big, and we can see where we're going, and we can see where we're headed, okay? We can see it. That's what the first right understanding, right view is. This is so important to be able to see the full map and know the direction that we're heading in before we start following along with our GPS. This is because, as I'm sure we've all experienced, sometimes our GPS can take us on some mighty long detours or, you know, take us around in circles, can it? Or maybe even dead ends that lead to absolutely nowhere. Or, you know. So we want to save ourselves some time as we begin walking on this path by using our GPS, which is right view or understanding. There's also a little bit of a trust factor here. When I was first writing this talk, I was going to a doctor's appointment. I'm fine. But my new GPS sent me in a circle through the neighborhood. And I was thinking, where is it taking me? I'm so confused. But I, you know, was kind of late. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to follow it. You know, I'm just going to follow it. So I stayed with it. And it turned out that the way it took me was brilliant, something I'd never experienced before. I'm like, wow, this is actually the best way to get here. I had no idea. It was like a great aha moment. And so walking this path often includes having a lot of trust, especially in the people who have walked it for many, many years, who tell us things that sometimes don't make any sense at all to us, it seems like, until suddenly, surprisingly, one day it's like, oh, right, I get it, that's true. You know? I had that experience with my own teacher, Pat, who I taught with this weekend, this seven-year-old man, you know, who sometimes, when he was teaching me, would tell me things that didn't seem to make any sense. And as a good Buddhist, I would argue with him, I don't believe that. What are you talking about? Until suddenly, when he's, he would say, And then one day, I'm like, oh, yeah, I get it. So as we continue to walk along the path, as you may have noticed, there's also a lot of sometimes recalculating. And you suddenly realize something new after you've been going around in circles, sometimes for years. About 30 years ago, when I first started practicing meditation and studying at Naropa University, which is kind of the nation's leading contemplative university, if anybody's interested in what that is, and the Shambhala, training in the Shambhala tradition as well. And I remember one of my professors, a woman named Judith Lee, talking about this even way back then, about the potential of the Buddha's teachings being watered down and emptied of much of its meaning in the West. Even back then, 30 years ago, that was her fear. If this starts getting out into the mainstream, it's going to be watered down and it's going to lose its meaning, very similar to how yoga has lost a lot of its meaning. And, you know, yoga has in some cases become a kind of exercise program that can help you look really good walking around in your yoga pants, you know, but doesn't lead to a lot of transformation. You know, not to say, by the way, that there's not a lot of amazing yoga teachers out there, because there are, and they teach directly from the Eastern tradition. You know, and I truly respect their teachings from the Eastern tradition. I respect that. But with meditation practice in particular, I feel really strongly that it is vital, not only for teachers, but for our students to understand right view, to really understand the terrain, really important for practice. Okay? So with that in mind, that up on my soapbox a little bit, with that in mind, I'd like to briefly review the three categories of practice on the wheel that the Buddha asks us to practice. So the first is ethical conduct, sila, S-I-L-I, sila, mental discipline, samadhi, and wisdom, panna, and or prajna sometimes it's called. And right view is in this wisdom category. The right view is in the category of wisdom, prana. Insight meditation is also referred to as shamatha vipassana. Shamatha is the mental discipline, the meditation practice. Vipassana is the wisdom factor, insight, what comes when we start investigating the nature of our mind. Sila, ethics, is really the kindness and compassion practice, which is threaded through the entire practice. So they all weave together, and you really need all three. And if you want a really simple way to remember these three sections or categories or instructions for our journey, our map, you know, the directions, they can be narrowed down to three main intentions. Three main intentions. And these are do no harm, act for the good, and purify the mind and heart. I'll read those again. Do no harm. That's the first one. Do no harm. Act for the good, the common good, not my good, the common good, and purifying the mind heart. And if you'll remember from the first talk again, it's essential that we include all three. You know, we can't just have mental discipline, you know, for instance, which is what many people are teaching now, and just learn how to calm the mind. Okay? We also need wisdom, and we need the teachings of great kindness and compassion, or really it's not going to lead us to transformation or to maybe less suffering for ourselves or others. In an article that my professor, Judy Lee, that I was talking about, in an article she wrote way back in 1997 for Tricycle Magazine, she wrote, if we do not understand the view, the practice of meditation can be more of a trap than a means of freeing ourselves from deception. Without the motivation to benefit others, meditation practice can degenerate into self-absorption and escapism. Rather than loosening our ego clinging, it could further perpetuate our ignorance and grasping. Rather than connecting us to our world, it could draw us away from it. Meditation practice could even be a tool of aggression, a way of clearing the mind before going out to commit our next murder. Right? In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha has this to say about right view and about our intentionality. Suppose bhikkhus, which means us, suppose bhikkhus a seed of sugarcane, hill rice, or grape were planted in moist soil. Whatever nutrients it would take up from the soil and from the water would all lead to its agreeable, sweet, and delectable flavor. For what reason? Because the seed is good. So too, for a person of right view and right liberation, whatever bodily karma, verbal karma, and mental karma he instigates and undertakes in accordance with that view, and whatever his volition, yearning, inclination, and volitional activities all lead to what is wished for, desired, and agreeable, to well-being and happiness. For what reason? Because the view is good. Okay. There's that analogy there. So what is it? What is right view and understanding? So tonight, if you can follow me on another metaphor of a map, I want to again say that all I can basically show you tonight is kind of the big globe of the practice and maybe where the biggest continents are. And your job is really to explore not only these continents, but maybe all the different countries and different states and all the little towns and villages, and maybe get down to all the little villages and the little intersecting roads in those villages and towns. That's your job. All I can do tonight is show you the globe, unfortunately. So traditionally, right view begins with an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It starts with that. So as a review, there is suffering, right? In what it, in Pali is called dukkha, suffering. There is a reason for this suffering, samyutta, arising. There is a way to stop this suffering, yay, nirodha, ending. And this way is the Noble Eightfold Path, magga, M-A-G-G-A, which means path. And if you put all of these together, the very long Pali word for this is dukkha nirodha gamini paripada, which means the way leading to the end of pain. I want that. The way leading to the end of pain. So we begin with the basic fact of existence. There is suffering. Anybody argue with that? Looking for show of hands. It, of course, happily does not mean that all life is suffering, because it's not. But we need to deeply recognize that there is suffering in both big and small ways. I actually love the word dukkha as opposed to suffering, because dukkha is described as a kind of inherent unsatisfactoriness of existence. Isn't that true? An inherent unsatisfactoriness of existence. And it's, I think I like that much better than the heavy word of suffering. And the Buddha talks about many forms of dukkha, and they do all sound a little dire. I'll read them. He says, birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the unpleasant is suffering. Separation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. So I find it helpful to break this up a bit. And remember that there are essentially three main forms of suffering, according to the teachings. So three main forms of ordinary suffering, which is dukkha-dukkha. Isn't that kind of fun? Dukkha-dukkha, ordinary suffering. There's suffering that's produced by change, vrittimana, virapramana dukkha. And there's suffering that's produced by the conditioned states, samkara-dukkha. Okay, so those three. Suffering, change, and conditioned states. So what is ordinary suffering? Dukkha-dukkha. And I think we all know this intuitively. It includes things like the pain of old age, sickness, and death, right? It also includes the pain of being associated with unpleasant persons and conditions. This is ordinary suffering. The pain of being separated from our loved ones and from pleasant conditions. The pain of not getting what we want, the pain of grief, lamentation, distress, which are all forms of physical and mental suffering. Okay. So that's dukkha-dukkha. The second kind of suffering is suffering produced by change, virapramana dukkha, which is, of course, intimately connected to ordinary suffering. And this includes the fact that pleasant and happy feelings or conditions in our lives, sadly, are not permanent. Sooner or later, they're going to change, aren't they? We can't keep them. We had a beautiful double rainbow on retreat this weekend. Couldn't keep it, you know? Beautiful. It goes. And when they go, we often experience both small and sometimes great pain. You know, suffering, unhappiness, disappointment. Then there's the suffering created by clinging to what are called the conditional states, samkara dukkha. And this is a really important part of the teachings to understand, that what we call me or self is really a combination of ever-changing mental and physical forces that can be divided into five groups or aggregates. And if anybody's interested, I think the aggregate talk I did a whole talk on the aggregates. I think it's up on the podcast. Okay. These five aggregates that the Buddha is referring to are what we are, what we actually are. And this is change itself. Change itself is what we are. And they include form, which is called rupa, sensations or feelings, vedana, perceptions, samjana, mental activity or formations, sankara, consciousness, vijnana, and all of these things are conditioned. All of these things are conditioned and constantly changing, aren't they? Our bodies are constantly changing. Our feelings are constantly changing. Our perceptions, aren't they, are constantly changing. Our mental activity, our thoughts, are constantly changing. And our consciousness, constantly changing. Is that true? Right? Is that true? Right?
Yeah.
We are made of these five aggregates, you know. And in essence, we don't actually have a solid, permanent self. That's a hard one for those of you who are new. And yet, we all tend to identify and cling to these five aggregates as self, as permanent. And that is one of the reasons that we suffer. So to summarize, the idea is that because everything is constantly changing, anicca, impermanence, we suffer, dukkha. Because we want to hold on to and cling to everything that supports a sense of self, which actually doesn't exist. Anatta, no self. Okay. These three factors, anicca, dukkha, anatta, are often called the three characteristics or the three marks of existence. There's always a three or an eight or a six, right? These are the three characteristics. About 10 years ago, an article in Time magazine came out and basically reported this. After more than a century of looking for it, brain researchers have long since concluded that there is no conceivable place for a self to be located in the physical brain and that it simply does not exist. So this is, in a nutshell, what the teachings of the five aggregates are pointing to. It does not exist. Which brings us to the second noble truth, samyutta arising. So we have dukkha, pain, because again we are clinging to that which is impermanent. Mind states, the weather, everything around us, you know, everything we love. We're clinging, we want it to be the same. And that, of course, includes our sense of self, right? We want that to be the same. The problem is, when we are believing in a solid, permanent self, we then spend almost every second, every moment of our lives constantly trying to avoid dukkha, unpleasantness, and trying to grasp onto and hang onto happiness and pleasure. Check it out in your own life and see if that's not true. We want everything to be permanent and lasting, our happiness, ourselves, again, everything we love. Even though we know from experience that this is not possible, we seem to keep trying anyway to do it. And this grasping quality is called tanha, T-A-N-H-A, and it's the most dominant and pervasive cause of our suffering. What the Buddha actually calls the origin of suffering is tanha, grasping, clinging. And again, this grasping quality all involves having a sense of a solid self. And if you really think about it, everything that you get stressed out about involves some sort of a perceived threat to your well-being, doesn't it? Everything you get stressed out about, it, just think about it for a moment. Isn't it a threat to your well-being in some way? So this threat might come in the form of a threat to your sense of ego. That happens a lot, right? Of being someone or something, some kind of disrespect. You know, someone is saying something about me or doing something to me that is in some way threatening my well-being. And so again, we are either defending not wanting or holding on to wanting. Wanting, not wanting. Wanting, not wanting. We're in a sense keeping ourselves drunk on what are called the three poisons, which are greed, aversion, and delusion. And with delusion, that final one is that we don't understand what's really causing our suffering, which is greed and aversion. And we have delusion. So often the Buddhist path is seen as kind of grim because people think that the emphasis is on suffering. But the emphasis isn't actually on suffering. It's about how to relieve ourselves from suffering, right? And yet in order to transcend suffering, we first need to deeply acknowledge and recognize that it exists. There is suffering, the first noble truth. And it's that it's part of being alive. You know, if we don't accept that, life's going to be really hard for us. We keep trying to push it away, the suffering and the pain and the disappointment. Guess what? It's going to be really hard. So we need to understand that it is our resistance to dukkha that actually increases our suffering. This is the truth, the second noble truth. And there's an old Buddhist equation that is simply pain times resistance equals the amount of suffering that we're going to have, right? Because it doesn't mean there's no pain. There is pain. But our resistance to the truth of those three characteristics, our resistance to it is what causes us to suffer. Think about anything you're struggling with right now. Isn't there a sense of, I wish this were different? In our world, maybe, on the larger stage, I wish this were different. And you might notice that everything we suffer with includes the statement, I want this thing or person that I don't have. I don't want that thing or person, you know, to go away. I want this thing to happen. I don't want this thing to happen. There's wanting and not wanting, right? They all involve a sense of, I wish this were different. I want that person to be different. I want the situation to be different. I want me to be different. Who wants me to be different? Anybody? Everybody? That's aversion. That's aversion. I'm just going to throw that out there. That is causing you suffering. Like a Carl Rogers quote I often give out on magnets to my MBSR students, many of you may have this, which is the curious paradox is that when I can accept myself just as I am, only then can I change. Only then can I change. And I like to imagine that you can change that quote to include everything. When I can accept other people, the situation, life, just as it is, it is only then that there is a possibility for change. Only then. Which leads us to the third noble truth, Nirodha ending, which simply reverses the equation. If craving or tanha is the cause of dukkha, then we can free ourselves from dukkha. Yay, there's a way out, right? There's a way out. All we need to do... You ready? All we need to do is eliminate craving or tanha, which means letting go of clinging so strongly to what we want and to stop pushing away what we don't want. So simple. Not, right? Not so much. Not so much. So with the fourth noble truth, magga, the Buddha gives us a very detailed, excellent instruction book for this, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, the 2,600-year-old GPS system and map for helping us to find our way home. Okay? So essentially, the Buddha is showing us how to live in the flow of what Jon Kabat-Zinn often calls the full catastrophe of our lives, all of it, not fighting life, and not clinging to it either, but feeling the vastness of it, feeling and experiencing all of it, being in the flow and the wave of all of it. Or like I often say in here, you know, the teachings of Bhikkhu Anayo, summarizing the entirety of the whole practice. You all know this by now, by heart, I hope, right? Keep calmly knowing change. That's it, you know? So when we can begin to let go of our grasping to a fixed and solid idea of who we are, when we aren't so attached to an image of self, or aren't so busy defending and protecting a self, there's so much more freedom and ease in our lives. We stop taking it so personally, making everything about me. And with less attachment to self, we tend to become less defensive, less wanting things to be different than they actually are. What the Buddha recognized is that it's really, truly not what happens to us or around us that's going to determine our level of happiness, but in fact how we relate and respond to what's happening around us. Which means that really, truly, the cause of all our dukkha is in here, or here. It's in here. And again, it's not that pain doesn't happen, or that we don't ever feel pain. Of course we do. Life is painful. There are accidents, there are deaths, there are riots, there are police shootings, there are children being put into cages. Painful, awful, evil things people inflict upon others. That's true. But we can cause ourselves so much more pain and suffering and dukkha by how we're thinking about it. It shouldn't be this way. They shouldn't be this way. I wish it was different. We can really pour the fuel onto that flame of our thinking and build it up and build it up and build it up until we have so much anxiety that we just don't know what to do with ourselves. So just recently, a private mentee of mine had a revolutionary, I would say, experience of this, of letting go. Bless you. She finally recognized that a very difficult, really frustrating situation that's been happening for a few years now at her workplace might actually just be this way for the foreseeable future, and that she may have absolutely no control over this. It's kind of like one of those aha moments, like, this might just be this way. I've been fighting this for 2 years or three or whatever it is. It might just be this way. It's like an aha moment. So she really had a sense of, okay, this is it. In the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, this is it. And bowed to it. And sort of miraculously, almost like the day that she had that revelation, true recognition, she asked herself the second part of that, this is it, phrase, which is now what? Right? How do I want to relate to this that will be of benefit to myself and benefit to all? What's the common good? How can I relate to this for the common good? And in that now what, she actually found a solution that she could see right away was going to be much better for everyone. Right? And it was really exciting, but she could see that she wouldn't have gotten there had she continued to battle, wanting it to be different, trying to fix it, wanting it to be different than it actually was. So finally, and I hope this isn't completely to confuse you, already confused, right view is a lot. Even the Buddha would likely agree that in the end, you need to be willing to let go of the view itself. In view. Let it go. So, quoting again from my old professor, meditation in and of itself is no magical cure-all. Proper understanding and proper motivation are important. The view informs the practice. Likewise, meditation balances view. Meditation practice is a way of loosening our solidity. I like that line. Without practice, even the most inspired view can become rigid ideology. The practice of meditation brings out the futility and limitations of holding any rigid view. We see the nature of our attachment to particular viewpoints and the simplicity of letting such views dissolve. The irony is that the proper motivation and view are essential, and at the same time, it is also essential not to grasp any view. It's a little bit of a Zen cone there. So I think I'm going to end there and invite us all to sit and maybe listen to the rain just for a moment. So even now, just seeing if you can really have a sense of letting go. See if you're clinging in any way, even right now, to wanting it to be a particular way. Wanting yourself to be a particular way. Situation, person. See if you can open the hands and see if you can offer a gesture of letting go. Imagine just completely letting go. Just even imagine that. Not wanting and not wanting. Just open. What would it feel like to set the suitcases down completely, all of it? And as you walk along the path, again, we let go, and we let go, and we let go even more. The great Ajahn Chah, who is my teacher's teacher's teacher, my lineage, wrote this. Do not try to become anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. If you haven't wept deeply, you haven't begun to meditate.